Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk.
Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my friends and co-hosts, Crystal and Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paula, and good morning, Crystal.
Good morning,
Andre. We are so excited. Thanks, Crystal, and good morning. Because joining us is Brian D. McLaren. Brian is an author, speaker, activist, philosopher, mega church pastor, public theologian, and I would add to the list a conceptual reframer and a marvelous cosmic citizen. He was named by Time Magazine as one of the 25 most influential people, and his friends like Richard Rohr refer to him as a spiritual genius. And after having read Brian's works, I can completely agree with that. Brian's writings include his acclaimed trilogy, A New Kind of Christian, A Generous Orthodoxy, and more recently, Naked Spirituality. But he's joining us today on the Cosmic Citizen to discuss his most recent book, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Mohammed Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
It is great to have you. So tell us a little bit, maybe even start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how is it that you came to this place you find yourself in your life right now?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, I grew up in a very conservative Christian household and had a wonderful childhood. My goal was to become a college English teacher. I was one of those kids who grew up loving literature and so I went to graduate school studying literature, and while I was in graduate school, became part of a little new church that was developing, and a couple years later was asked to leave my teaching job and become the pastor. So I became a pastor kind of by surprise for 24 years, and during that time, I started asking a lot of questions about my own inherited religious tradition. And that really sent me on a kind of journey that prompted me to start writing. So in 1998, my first book came out, and that seemed to get some resonance among people. So I've been writing ever since. I left the pastorate in 2006, so it's 6.5 years now. I've been living and working as a writer and speaker and networker and that sort of thing. And this topic, obviously, I think all of us who are concerned about well-being of our children and grandchildren, we all have to be concerned about the threat of religious violence, not only theirs, whoever they might be, but also ours, whoever we might be. And so I've been grappling with that as I read the headlines, and especially I think we would all agree since September 11, 2001, we've all felt this in our daily lives. But a couple of years ago, I just felt like, boy, I've got to grapple with this as a Christian, writing to my fellow Christians about where hostility can be rooted in our own religious identity. So that really brought me into this research project, and it's been a great experience.
And you are understandably a leader in the emergent Christian movement, which makes complete sense to me because of the things that you're saying in your books. And I got your book, your most recent book, at the Wild Goose Festival, and am just absolutely loving it. I mean, it just makes so much sense to me. And
well,
I think you kind of sometimes apologize, say, you know, well, you might not agree with me, but, and you put it out there courageously and clearly and thoughtfully, and in a thought-provoking way. And I just love the fact in the book that you give us the benefit of Christian history and this idea of how Christianity has become imperial in a way, or been taken over by a Roman ideology, which honestly never occurred to me. But other religions, certainly there are hostilities between religions, and you really describe that. Why do you think there is so much hostility between religions?
Well, the standard answer to that is that we're different, and that we are all somewhat allergic to differences, and there's certainly some truth to that. I think I'm sure there's a biochemical brain chemistry dimension to this, where what is familiar to us feels safe, and what is unfamiliar can feel dangerous. But the more I read and researched and reflected on my own experience and talked with religious leaders from many different traditions, I came to the kind of surprising conclusion that our real source of religious hostility is not in our differences. It's in the one thing that all of our religions hold in common, and that is the way that we build religious identity. One way to say it is that in spite of all of our different doctrines and histories and rituals and practices and priorities, at the heart of almost all of our religions is a practice of building a strong sense of us by creating some sense of opposition to them. And so building identity through opposition to the other ends up being this one thing we have in common that is our biggest problem.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, you know, because in many ways, people of faith have more in common with each other than we do with those of no faith, or, you know, I would say people who are, you know, really strictly materialists, and yet we sort of build these walls that keep us from enjoying that sort of cosmic fellowship, or you know, sort of reveling in the, what the French say, vive la différence,
yes.
Sort of reveling in the differences.
You know, I when you talk about people of faith and people without faith, I immediately think of a friend of mine who grew up in a Christian context, went to seminary, and while he was in seminary, he lost his faith. It just disappeared on him, and he became an atheist. And as an atheist, he started trying to find other atheists. And when he was with them, he found the same kind of sectarianism among some of the atheist groups he was associated with, and they were constantly speaking of those stupid believers and all the rest. And so, you know, he then started to say, well, hold it, these are my friends, and I know these people. And someone said to him, you're not a true atheist, you're a faithiest. And
a faithiest?
Boy.
He decided to take that and wear it as a badge of honor. And so now we often talk about interfaith dialogue, but he's trying to develop relationships across the barrier of agnostics and atheists and people of faith. And I just think it's a reminder to us that some of this is probably a reflection of some very, you know, deep-seated tribalism that exists in all of us. And so it doesn't matter if we're talking about a religious tribe, a political tribe, a philosophical tribe, an academic tribe, we can create these same kinds of oppositional identities.
Very true.
And so, yeah, and you really, one thing I love so much about this book is you try to look at us from Jesus' point of view. I think you, at least this is what I get, you've taken on Jesus' point of view, hence your question, you know, why did Jesus and Moses and Buddha and Muhammad cross the road? And you go one step further to say, how do you think Jesus would treat Moses, Muhammad, and the Buddha should they meet up on the road or in a bar? And I love that thought-provoking question. How do you think he would treat them, Brian?
Well, you know, this to me is what becomes so, gives me a lot of hope. Because if we, in each of our different traditions, would get more serious about following our leaders, following our founders, rather than following our fellow followers, I think we'd be in a much better place. When you think about Jesus, if you know anything about Jesus from the Gospels, he was an astute judge of human character. And when I say judge, I don't mean someone who likes to critique and condemn. He had the very opposite habit. He would look at someone that everyone else was critiquing and condemning, and he would see something praiseworthy in them. He would look at someone everyone was about to throw stones at, and he would stand with them and see value in them. So you can be sure that if Jesus were to see faith in a woman of another religion, faith in a Roman centurion, if he were to meet the Buddha or Muhammad, he would be the one to really see all the good that was in them. But I think the same is true for these other religious leaders. People don't often remember that the story of Moses is a story of conflicted religious identity, born to a Hebrew slave family, then adopted by Egyptian nobility. He has this classic dual identity. He's identified with both the oppressed and the oppressors. When he tries to negotiate that as a man, he's driven out by both groups, and then finds himself as a refugee in yet another culture, and marries a woman of a different religion, and ends up having a deep relationship with her father, who's the priest of this other religion. So here Moses, emerges in a context where he's had to learn to negotiate all kinds of religious complexity. And of course, we could say the same for Muhammad. I was just with a Muslim friend of mine last night, and he was telling me a couple of stories that are precious to Muslims about Muhammad interacting with people of other faiths, Jews and Christians. His followers were scandalized at the level of respect that he showed for people of other faiths, setting an example, you know, that would be great for more people to follow today.
That's a very important point that you bring out. Again, you know, drawing the distinction between, you know, following the founders rather than the followers and those kinds of examples. And it begs the question, you know, you can have the intellectual realization that this is what Jesus would do, but given the level of entrenched kind of behavior that people have, that they've been schooled for so long in this us and them thinking, how do you take that intellectual realization and move it to a level of higher operacy, for lack of a better term, where the behavior can actually change? How do you envision that happening?
Well, Andre, that's a fantastic question. And it's one of the questions I'm very sensitive to, because I'm a writer now and I'm dealing with ideas, but for 24 years I was a pastor, and I really had to work on the grassroots level with how these ideas get translated into behavior and practice and values and so on. So I just think that's an extremely important question. I would say maybe there would be three dimensions of this, two of which I really focus on in this book, and one of which I focused on in my previous book. But those three dimensions would be the dimension of liturgy. By that I mean all of the rituals and practices that we share, whatever our denomination, they might vary, but we each have our own set of them. Those liturgical practices can be ways of either enforcing a hostile and fearful and isolated identity, or they can be practices of opening our hearts to the other. We can talk more about that, but I'll just mention the other two. Second would be what we might call our missional practices. That's where we go out into the world working for the common good. And that not only means mission to people of other faiths, that's what we focused on in the past, but I think in the future we need to focus much more deeply on mission with people of other faiths. The fact is the greatest problems that threaten us now are problems that we're going to need all hands on deck for, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, everybody. We're going to have some collaboration. So that kind of mission, I think, has a profound effect of engaging us with the other in more productive ways. And then the third would be in our own personal spirituality, the practices that we all have to keep our own hearts healthy and open and engaged. And I think there are ways that we can cultivate our own spiritual life that increase our desire for harmony and respect for relationships, as you all would say, as cosmic citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. I like your emphasis on personal spirituality and emphasis on the heart, because, I mean, doesn't it occur to us that it's really focusing on the beliefs and our identification with particular belief systems as being representative of who we are that seems to drive a wedge between us, whereas when we focus on goals, values, evaluations, directions, things that really hinge more on at least a low-level way of describing what spirituality is about, that somehow those things unify us. You know, when we look at a Muslim or a Jew or anyone, you know, describing their own faith, they're going to describe the loving aspects of it, ultimately.
Yeah. Yes, there's so much there, Andre. The ability for us to ask questions of one another,
mm-hmm,
that elicit our primary and primal spiritual experience. I mean, this is just something we're very unpracticed in. I had an experience of this some years ago. I got to know an imam from a mosque near the church that I served, and he and I started having lunch about once every month or so, and we were having lunch one day, and I said, could you tell me the story of how you came to be an imam? And I got the feeling that no one had ever really asked him that before, and so he shared that story, and I just listened and wanted to find out, when he was a child, was this something he aspired to? What was it that attracted him to this life? What was challenging? What was enjoyable? And then he turned and asked that question to me. Well, in a beautiful way that day, I'll never forget, we each opened our hearts to one another through something, in a sense, that we had in common, which was a profession of being spiritual leaders. But in spite of our different stories, we had so much in common. Our differences are important and real. I'm not one to say the way to peace is by saying that we're all the same. I think we'll have a much better peace and harmony if we learn to love and accept and appreciate one another's differences. Some of my friends say that there's a great danger of taking all of our religious recipes, throwing them into the blender, hitting puree, and then trying to serve out a kind of religious smoothie. That's not what I'm recommending. But when we can realize that there are common experiences for all human beings, and then there are differences. We come from different lands, and different traditions, and different problems. It makes possible, I think, a beautiful and healthy and sustainable way of relating.
Well, and it seems like our diversity is really necessary and something that we should revel in and celebrate rather than being so defensive about or have difficulty with, because isn't that the thing that makes it interesting, meeting another person? You know, finding
right.
out what is unique and original and special and different, because really, even with the people in the same pew, in the same church, in the same congregation, we probably have very different perspectives on what the pastor is talking about or what the service is about that day. Even within the same family, we see tremendous differences in perspective, especially when it comes to something as deep and personal as spirituality and religion.
I think you're getting at something that is of great interest to me and I think very important. That is that no two people have exactly the same concept of God.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we can acknowledge that, we realize the difference between people's concepts of God among 10 Christians are great. And then you could take 10 Jews or 10 Muslims, 10 Hindus. Each of them is, because of their experiences, because of the particular teachers they had, the books they've read, and so on, they'll have a different set of images of God. And, of course, those even change over time. Probably all of us at the age
right.
of 60, 40, 20, and 5, you know, we would say we have very different evolving images of God. And when we can make that distinction, we realize that whoever and whatever God really is not exactly the same thing as the mental image that I have of God. That
exactly.
opens up a level of humility that makes new levels of dialogue possible.
Absolutely. I think if we come from that point of view, that unique point of view, and realizing that everyone else has a unique point of view.
Yeah.
And two people can look at the same thing and describe it completely differently. Two people can look at the same thing or listen to the same masterpiece of music or look at a masterpiece of art and get something completely different out of that. And yet each one is gratified, and that's good. That's a good thing. And when we come together to share, I mean, if you go to a museum, you want to take a friend because you want to hear their insights. You want to see how that moves them and feel their passion as well as your own. It's important to acknowledge the other person's passion. And I think that, you know, I was just reading in the last couple of days your story about you and the imam, and you asked him at one point, or he asked you, about Christianity, and you said, well, it's my love of Jesus. I just love Jesus. And he kind of paused at that, and he said, I never considered that. I've always judged Christianity by what other Muslims have told me, but I've never considered that you just love Jesus, and I love Jesus. He admitted to you that he loves Jesus.
Yes.
And I've had Muslims admit this to me. They love Jesus. Jesus is a prophet in their eyes. And
so many Christians don't realize that about Muslims.
Right. That started a conversation about what prophet means, and then a wonderful conversation. But the reality is you both love Jesus. And I think you made a comment to him about, or, you know, to the reader about, you know, would Jesus then have said, or should I have then said, well, your concept of Jesus is all wrong. When he just told you and admitted to you that he loves Jesus.
Yes.
Isn't that enough?
Mm-hmm.
And you can celebrate the fact that you both do. How beautiful is that? And, you know, it made me think, you know, wouldn't it be a great conversation instead of saying Jesus loves me most to say Jesus loves you most? No, I insist. Jesus loves you.
Right.
I like that. That's great. That's great.
Brian, how did you come up with the title for this book?
Well, we were working with several different titles, and I really felt that we needed something that had a little bit of humor in it and a little bit of intrigue. Humor because I could use this example. I was a pastor for 24 years, and as a pastor, I did a lot of pre-marriage counseling, and I found that whenever a couple came, and also marriage counseling, and I found that whenever a couple came and they were having big problems and they both had furrowed brows and their jaws were clenched, they were very serious about this problem, we never got anywhere. But if we could get to the place where people could loosen up and laugh at themselves a little bit, the very act of lightening up opened up the possibilities that we could get to some more creative and helpful solutions. I think the same happens in the religious world. Of course, we take our religious commitment seriously, but that very seriousness can sometimes mean we're taking ourselves too seriously and our group too seriously. So I thought a little bit of humor wouldn't hurt us there, evoking that old joke. But also, by asking a question in the title, I wanted to get people imagining our religious founders actually doing something together, walking together, encountering one another. And that allows us then to refocus on our relationship to our founders and less on the relationship of our religious communities to one another with all of their historical conflicts. Every religion that I've ever encountered has stories to tell. And part of their lexicon of stories includes stories of persecution. Almost every religion has been persecuted by some other religion. And what unfortunately happens in religion, as in politics and as in personal relationships, is that we create these vicious cycles of offense and then revenge and then more offense and more revenge. And at each level of that cycle, our outrage increases. And there's no departure from that cycle until it leads to violence and ultimately genocide, unless at some point we say this cycle is self-destructive and we have to find some, instead of a vicious cycle, we have to find a gracious cycle. And that involves forgiveness and reconciliation. It involves admitting the failures of our tradition toward the other and being open then for them to admit their failures in relation to us. And to me, it's a very, very beautiful and hopeful process that I can't see any way of getting there without getting to where we need to be without that process. It's very much what you see exemplified in the post-apartheid era in South Africa in the truth and reconciliation process. That there, if we want to depend on bad memory to get us beyond our past offenses, I don't think it's going to work. I think we have to have a constructive commitment to truth and reconciliation.
You know, I can't agree with you more. And what you're speaking about begs the question for me, Brian, it has to somehow transcend these ideas that we have about each other, and yet somehow if we're in our ideas about each other, we're held back from being able to transcend each other. And I think about my own, personal religious life, per your three things that need to happen. And it's just getting me to reflect on the fact that if I don't have a living relationship with the God as I conceive of God, somehow I don't get that energy or I don't get that being pulled up that needs to happen in order for me to face what are essentially spiritual challenges. For me to be able to surrender my identity as what have you, a Muslim, a Christian, or however I conceive myself to be, and say, I'm going to just relate with you one-on-one as my brother or sister, requires a deep act of faith that somehow God is going to uphold that process, that God loves me enough to to allow me to do that, and in fact is encouraging me to do that. And I mean that literally, encouraging me.
Yeah.
It takes real courage in order to release oneself from the potential fears. What do you see as like first steps in that direction?
I'm really glad our conversation is taking this turn, Andre, because this emphasis on our personal openness to God and our personal spiritual posture, if you will, I think you're focusing on the word courage is really essential, because one of the things that we have to do at some point is we have to have the courage to doubt what we've been told by important people in our religious community.
Wow.
We see this in terms of race. You know, a lot of us are old enough, if we're white, we remember the days where white folks typically said things about black folks. And all of us weren't born with racial prejudice, but we inherited it from our grandparents or parents or uncles or aunts or whatever. And we had to reach a point at some point in our lives where we said, you know what, I don't believe what they told me. I doubt what they told me. That always takes courage.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found in my life is that I will not have the courage to stand up to powerful and influential people in my life and groups in my life unless it comes from a very, very deep place, as you said, a place where I feel the love of God is compelling me to do this. That before God, this is what I have to do. Otherwise, I'm forfeiting my integrity. And it's no surprise that if people haven't cultivated that deep inner life and that deep inner connection to the Spirit of God, when push comes to shove, they'll buckle to the prejudices of the groups to which they belong. So at some point, there is this very personal, private moment of courage where a person says, I might lose my friends, people might think worse of me, but I'm going to cross the road, and I'm going to I'm going to make contact.
Yeah.
I had an epiphany once when I was younger, and I was feeling awfully sorry for myself because I had been so misunderstood, and I was talking this over with God, and I told God, you know what, how come when I have such good intentions, how can I be so misunderstood? Mm. And immediately I thought of Jesus, and I thought of all the wonderful people that have ever lived on this planet. We certainly can say nobody ever had better intentions than Jesus, and he was also the most misunderstood.
Yes.
And in that moment, I realized exactly what you two are saying, and that is the courage to go ahead and be misunderstood, even maligned, for holding up a truth that you, a conviction that you have in your heart that is transcendental of what people are saying or what they think or where they are in their particular journey. To have that, and I've come to call it the courage of my convictions, to be able to stand for what I believe is right and true and good and beautiful. And, you know, and face, you know, the onslaught of whatever is coming at me because of that. And you're right, I couldn't do it without that ability to tap into my deeper self, my deeper wisdom, you know, to put that taproot down into the infinite resources.
You know, when you say that, I think of a story from the Gospel of Luke. It comes, I think, in chapter 4, so near the beginning of Jesus' public life, and he goes to his hometown, Nazareth. And, of course, the hometown evokes all of the normal prejudices and assumptions that comes from our home community. And he says these great words that the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. He's quoting from the prophet Isaiah that God cares about the poor, so now there's going to be good news for the poor and for the oppressed. And of course, people love to hear that because we all like to think of ourselves as the oppressed. And so that's good news for us. And so everybody is applauding and feeling great about Jesus at that moment. And then the next thing Jesus does is he tells a couple stories from his Hebrew scriptures about God helping outsiders. One was about how a prophet helped a widow from Sidon, another nation, and another was about how God helped a man named Naaman, who was a military officer from Syria. And the people are upset. And I just think what a fascinating move Jesus makes at that moment. Right when everybody's praising him, he says, "But remember, it's not just about our little tribe here. God loves the other guys too." And he uses his position of respect on behalf of the other at that moment. I think that's a beautiful example of how Jesus has this care for the other, how he models it. And it becomes a way for us, I think, to then have courage to stick our necks out in the same way.
Hmm. Well, what do you say to somebody when they are offended? I mean, do you have a way of diffusing that situation? Or?
Well, I think of two difficult situations. The first is if I'm in the presence of a fellow Christian who starts saying insulting, prejudicial, ignorant, harmful things about Muslims or Jews or Hindus or Buddhists or atheists or whoever. One of the things I've learned to say in that situation is, "Wow, I see that differently." And, of course, as soon as I say that, a person wants to know what I see differently. And I try not to answer them. I try to say, "Well, I don't need to get in an argument with you. I don't need to try to convince you I'm right. I just want you to know that I see that differently." And you might say, "Well, why don't you try to convince them that you're right?" Well, what I've experienced is whenever I try to convince someone to change their opinion, they usually dig in their heels and become more firmly committed to defending it.
Right.
If I can give them the gift of being willing to differ graciously and not change my affect toward them, not change my love and interest in them, but I'm just willing to say, "Okay, you see it that way, I see it another way." In some ways, that's the greatest gift I can give them at that moment. Now, if they're really interested, of course, we can talk about it. But anyway, that's how I try to handle those situations. Another situation, though, is where a person gets angry or upset with me because they feel I've betrayed some of the core definitions of us. So for me, that means as a Christian, mm-hmm. by showing love and respect to them, whoever that might be. And I've always found that a little trickier. But I find I have to do a lot of explaining in that situation. I have to say, "Look, I'm not showing love to my Muslim friend in spite of the fact that I'm a committed Christian. I'm showing love to my Muslim friend because I'm a committed Christian." And I can help them see how that works. Now, I'll tell you what's interesting, and this is different in every different religious community, but among a lot of more conservative Christians, whenever you bring up the issue of Christians relating to people of other faiths, they want to quote a verse from the Gospel of John. They want to quote John 14:6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." And they want to quote that as if to say, if you're too nice to people of other faiths, you're showing that you don't really believe that verse. And,
oh, boy.
This is so predictable in many of these situations. I've just been on a book tour lately, and I can't tell you, I think every night except one so far of the book tour, that question has come up. So, this is a deeply ingrained religious habit, to quote that verse. And so what very often I like to do is I like to say, "Well, let's really look at that verse. And if we can find a Bible, I'll get it, open it up, and we'll say, what does that mean? What's the context for that verse?" And I help them see that their use of that verse is really a misapplication. It's like, you know, taking a tool and turning it into a weapon. And so... So those kind of conversations have to happen. And sometimes I think we aren't prepared for them, and that's okay, too. We just have to say, I don't feel right about going along with the normal response here. And I'll have to look into it. We can talk again in the future.
I really like what your other comment though was saying in terms of how you respond to somebody that is essentially modeling how they're identifying with a negative position,
yeah.
And how then, in a way, one way to characterize what you're doing is you're modeling disidentification from a belief system while yet not disidentifying from that person as being related to you.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's a delicate challenge, isn't it?
But it does subtly thrust it up from that level of the mind, that level of even, you might even call it ego identification, to the level of self-identification, the level of identifying with who that person truly might be on the level of values, trying to elevate what the discussion might be. Because the person is definitely going to be provoked to think twice about not only their position, but you know, why it is that you're still talking to them if you disagree, especially if what most of their experience is that if I don't agree with somebody, if we have a mental conflict, then they're also out of my circle, which is what a lot of people's life experience is about.
Yes, that's it.
We don't have a lot of experience spiritually or religiously, it seems, in really practicing reconciliation as a lifestyle, you know, like you were talking about with doing marital counseling. You know, that's a place where we all find conflict, you know, that we just don't see things the same way as men and women. We don't perceive things the same. And yet when we discuss these challenges or these issues, we're frequently discussing them with members of the same sex rather than with members of the opposite sex. So we tend to reinforce our initial prejudice or initial misperception. And I think that extends into religious community, that if we're always discussing things with people who think more similarly to the way we do, we're not going to really understand how that process of reconciliation works.
Yes, it reminds me of something I read somewhere. It's impossible to reconcile with a friend. You can only reconcile with an enemy. and in some ways, you know, when we take our, I'm thinking of 1 Corinthians 13, the passage that's always read at weddings, as the great love chapter. Of course, it wasn't written for weddings. It was written for daily life. But when you think of the characteristics of love, love is patient. Well, you only need patience when somebody's annoying you, you know. love is kind. Well, you only need kindness when someone is making demands on you that you decide to be generous toward. And you just go down that list. Love is patient when wrong. Well, you can only be patient and wrong when someone is wronging you. So it's in the very condition of conflict that real love can be developed and exercised. And this is another, I think, one of our great challenges in our faith communities. Wouldn't it be great if we could count on the fact that if we go to church 52 Sundays a year, we're going to get 52 challenges and 52 how-to sessions of how to become more loving people. And this to me is one of the tragedies and one of the really problems that I've dedicated a big part of my life to, and I can hope to continue working on this in the future, is to find ways that those 52 hours or whatever each year will be better used to nudge us in the direction of more love and more wisdom and more motivation to engage with one another in constructive ways.
It does seem like we can easily overlook or misunderstand, I don't know if that's quite the right word, but the admonition or the commandment most often repeated by Jesus in every context was that we love one another.
Yeah.
You know, that of all of these, the greatest commandment is that you love each other. And, you know, I've looked at this quite a bit personally in putting together workshops or seminars on practical applications of that commandment. You know, because really, we don't really know very well how to love one another. We talk a lot about that issue, but and we use the word a lot, but we don't really talk about the breakdown of those of that skill set.
It's true. It's a little strange, isn't it, that we spend countless hours in kindergarten through 12th grade and then more hours in college studying arithmetic and studying history and so on. And you compare that to how little time we actually spend saying, how can I become a more forgiving person?
Oh.
How does one learn to resolve conflicts? And you realize so much of our success and happiness and well-being depends on this, we might call it a moral skill set. And yet we almost act as if, oh, that's easy, you'll pick that up on your own.
Yeah. The most difficult or most challenging of all, life happiness skills, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and interpersonal relationship skills, which are clearly the most difficult for us humans and for human beings on this world. It's a challenging life. And, you know, I have to go back to Jesus saying, you know, when they asked him, how will we know them? And he said, by their fruits you will know them. And again, Brian, what you were saying about that list about love, it's the same with the fruits of the Spirit. You can't practice the fruits of the Spirit except in relationship. And to me, what he was also saying, too, was take time to get to know them, because you won't know if they're kind and loving and loyal and honest and sincere in an instant. You can't know that by what church they go to or by what religion they proclaim to be or by what books they claim to read. You can only know their fruits by getting to know them. You know, how can I, you know, immediately decide, well, you're Muslim, therefore your fruits are, you know. I mean, that's absurd. That can't be done, and I want to remind our listeners, if you're just turning in, we are interviewing Brian McLaren, author, speaker, activist, philosopher. And Brian, it's so great to have you on the show. And I wanted to ask you, you know, clearly the world is in a dangerous and volatile place. And we saw that just recently with this video that got the whole Muslim world in an uproar, pretty much. How do you, you know, what should we do to keep positive? And, you know, because we can only affect a small sphere of people, each person in their own way. What's the best thing we can do to really change the world and make it a more loving place?
Well, so much begins with that command of Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself. So very often it's going to start with a neighbor, and very often it's going to start with a stranger who becomes a neighbor. One of the things I would wish for everyone who's listening is that if you don't currently have some friends of other faiths, that you would just, that's a great thing to pray about, to ask God for the gift of some friends from other faiths who you could get to know. I think about a friend of mine named Nadine, a Christian woman whose children became friends at school with Muslim children. And so she eventually met the mother of her children's playmates. And that was her first Muslim friend she'd ever had. Well, they were brought together by their love for children. And a deep friendship has developed that both of them, I know, would say has enriched and changed their lives and set an example for a lot of other people. So there's just an awful lot of old-fashioned neighborliness that can happen. And I think that that's a big first step.
Who is your first Muslim friend, Brian?
I tell in the book a story of a boy who I won't use his real name, but the name I use in the book is Atif. And what happened was when my wife and I got married, we went away for our honeymoon, and my brother so kindly says, "Well, while you're gone, your apartment is going to become open. I will move all your furniture into your apartment, so it's there when you get back." So, you know, that was so nice of him. And we got back about midnight from our honeymoon, and we took a cab back to our apartment that we'd never been in before. And we went in this apartment, and we're ready to start our life together. But, of course, we needed to use the bathroom after a long plane ride, and we found out my brother had blown up, I don't know how many hundred balloons, and he had filled the bathroom from floor to ceiling with balloons so that when you tried to open the door, it just sort of pushed back on you. And so we couldn't pop all those balloons in the middle of the night without getting somebody to call the police. So we just sort of put them on the floor. And the next day, I went out front of my apartment, sat on the front step, while my new bride was sleeping in, and this little boy plopped it down beside me, and I just got an idea. I asked him if he liked balloons, and he said, "Yeah, I do," and I showed him the balloons. He went and rounded up all the kids in the neighborhood, and they created a conveyor belt of getting all the balloons out of our room. And from that day forward, little Atif was inseparable. He just became like an additional member of our family. And through him, we got to know his mother, who was an Iranian Muslim, a Shiite Muslim. And this was back in the days when there was a lot of political tension between the U.S. and Iran. Of course, some things never change, but this was when there had been a hostage crisis. And Iranians at that time, probably as now, who lived in the United States, felt a lot of prejudice. And when this little boy, Atif's mother, spread the word to her Iranian friends that she had met some Americans who really liked her and liked Iranians and liked Iranian food and so on, you know, we then sort of got an entree into a whole circle of new friends. So it's just, who would have guessed that this simple act of meeting a little boy would lead to this whole new circle of friends that enriched our lives and forever made it impossible for me to believe the prejudicial things that were said about Muslims or Iranians or whatever.
Hmm.
Well, and especially sort of giving a kid not only some balloons, but all the balloons they could possibly carry. What a way to get into a kid's heart.
Yeah, and of course they were doing us a really big favor too.
And then I like the
benefit.
Part in the story where you talk about sharing meals together. You know, what a wonderful ritual metaphor, enriching experience that is, sort of breaking bread with people from different culture, with different types of food, different cuisine, but also different style of fellowshipping with that meal.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that ideal.
Yes, well, for me as a Christian, this is so fascinating because when you read the Gospels, Jesus is constantly getting in trouble for his eating habits. I don't mean that he put his elbows on the table, but that he would eat with people who everybody said he shouldn't eat with, notorious sinners, people with a bad reputation.
Yeah.
I can't help but think that when Jesus instituted the Last Supper that we often call the Eucharist or Communion, and he told the disciples to remember him, part of what he was saying in that is, remember the way that I have sat at table with anyone. I've been willing to engage with anyone, and let your celebration of this meal be a reminder to you that just as you're welcome at my table, I want everyone to be welcome at your table as well. There's an amazing follow-up to that whole theme that you see in the four Gospels. It comes in the book of Acts. I happen to remember the chapter number. It's chapter 10, And in that chapter, the Apostle Peter ends up encountering a family from another religion. His tradition tells him, I should not let these people into my home. I should not go into their home. I definitely should not eat a meal with them. And yet that's exactly what God leads Peter to do. And in his encounter with his family, it's a man named Cornelius and his family, in his encounter, the first thing he says to these people is, now I realize that I should never call anyone unclean. And this is one of the great problems in religion. Religion tries to make us love the clean, love what's pure, love what's good, which is a good thing, but often it has an unintended consequence of teaching us then to hate people who we don't think are up to our standards, you know, whether it's doctrinal standards, behavior, whatever. And here Peter is guided by God into this profound experience where his old dualistic category, the clean and the unclean, is broken down. What an amazing story to have in the New Testament.
Oh, yeah. Indeed.
Truly amazing.
And don't we all, I mean, don't all of our religions have real clear ideas about what uncleanliness is? More so in a way than even focusing on what cleanliness is in a spiritual sense.
Unfortunately, I think you're right. And so we have these indicators of uncleanness that then allow us to judge people and write them off immediately. I'm thinking when you say that, what would be the primary indicator of cleanness? In other words, what would we look for in people if we weren't looking in this dualistic, prejudicial way? And I mentioned a minute ago how people often quote John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and life, as their way of dismissing people of other faiths. And I often think, well, maybe what we should do is teach them instead to quote a verse from 1 John chapter 4 that says, God is love, and whoever loves is born of God and knows God. My goodness, that would send us looking for different qualities, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, really, if Jesus took the point of view that so many of us take, looking for a reason to disqualify others from our circle of love and friendship, he would never have come to this world.
That's right.
He would have disqualified it right from the get-go because it's so unclean. but like you said, the physician, you know, the healthy need no physician.
Yes.
He came to save us from our own humanness because there's an intrinsic value that he puts on us. And that's the value that hopefully we will look for in each other at some point in the future when we realize that we're all members of the same cosmic family and we all have value to our Creator, value that is irreplaceable and without duplicate. And so, you know, and I'd like to, we have some callers stacking up, Brian, but before we take some calls, I think it's really important that you kind of divide our identities into three categories, which are benevolent but weak, strong but kind of militant. I can't think of the word you used.
Hostile.
I'm sorry. Yeah, hostile. And strong and benevolent. And certainly Jesus was strong and benevolent, and it's not something we've ever been able to wrap our minds around how that works, but you know, can you expound on that a little bit? What does a strong, benevolent Christian identity, or religious identity for that matter, look like?
Yes. Well, this, as you say, I what I had seen commonly in my own experience and what I found relatively easy to practice myself is a strong, hostile identity, which is I know what I believe, and if you don't believe it, I'm out to set you right or I'm going to avoid you or whatever. Strong, hostile. Some people immediately say, I don't want to do that, and they go to the other extreme, which is, okay, I don't want to play this strong, hostile game, so I'm going to minimize my religious identity so I can be tolerant of other people. The word I use in the book is I talk about a weak and tolerant or a weak and benign. So I don't want to do you harm, but I'm not particularly committed to your well-being either. And the third alternative is the alternative of a strong Christian identity. The stronger my commitment to Christ, to the gospel, to this way of life, the more passionately I'll be committed to moving toward the other, to loving the other, to protecting the other, to laying my life down for the other. And so my benevolence grows stronger with my commitment. And there are so many examples of this, you know, through Christian history, and thankfully so many great examples of this today. I think there's a photograph that I have that I just cherish, and it's a picture of Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, a committed Christian, Anglican Christian, sitting with Dalai Lama, and they're on a panel speaking somewhere, but they're laughing together, and they look for all the world like two little boys who want to run out of the meeting and go play on the playground. And you can tell that they're not watering down their Christian or Buddhist commitment to be interested in each other. It's an expression of their commitment that they're kind and compassionate and interested in each other. And that's that's what I'm aiming for in my own life, and I hope other people will as well.
Don't you feel sometimes that people really do confuse power with aggression? And that, you know, in my own personal life experience, you know, I happen to sort of been born with, I guess, sort of a passionate personality, or some people would say a strong-willed personality. And my parents were both medical missionaries. My dad was a doctor. My mom was a nurse. My dad had a more assertive personality, or more assertive role. My mother had a more passive and benevolent kind of role, and fairly typical male and female in that way. But part of nursing was, you know, nurturing, taking care of people who were sick. And part of being a mom is, you know, sort of putting your own ego aside and taking care of others, where my dad's approach to care and ministry was much more assertive in his position as doctor. And I, as a female, didn't really identify so much with the gentle side. I was definitely more assertive and more aggressive and liked doing more, you know, active sorts of things. But over time, I got the message that enthusiastic, passionate expression of myself was less ladylike or less appropriate, in some cases even less Christian for a female. But over time, I realized that what it was that my dad had sort of instilled in my brother and me a sort of a sense of self-confidence, self-respect. And it wasn't really about ego. It was really about just feeling confident that we were loved by him, that we were loved by God, that we were lovable, and that what we had to say or what we thought was worth expressing. And as I matured, I realized I did have to sort of tone some of that down in order to be more socially appropriate, more socially acceptable. But I see this often as a reflection of being threatening to other people's ideas of, I don't know exactly how to, maybe it's humility. Or maybe it's this idea that we're all sinners, so we can't be expressing any confidence in our identity. I'm not being very articulate here, but I have strong feelings associated with it.
Succinctly, isn't that not raising your head so high that it could get your neck could get chopped off? Isn't that something like that?
Perhaps.
Well, on that happy note, let's take some callers.
Okay.
Callers, I'm going to try to take you in the order that you've been holding the longest because, and I thank you. I want to say thank you for waiting because we wanted to give Brian a chance to share with us some of his ideas and concepts. So we'll take the first caller from area code 541. Caller, you're with us on Blog Talk and Brian McLaren.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. This is Suzanne, and I'm actually just listening, so I'm going to go ahead and exit out.
Okay, Suzanne, just keep listening. That's fine. Caller, you're with us on Blog Talk and Brian McLaren.
Oh, I'm just
listening
as well.
Just listening as well. Okay, great. Want to be sure I get everybody, just in case they have a question. And I should remind our callers that our number is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158 if you want to call and ask Brian a question or make a comment. And we have one more here holding. Area code 510, you're with us on Blog Talk. Brian McLaren.
This is retired Rabbi Gershom Steinberg Cordell. And first off, I would wish you Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
And would like to offer a couple of observations that I have obtained from your wonderful discussion this morning. And I love the idea how you are referring to this as an interfaith discussion, and feel very welcomed by it. So,
Rabbi, can I ask you to turn your computer down a little bit? Then you won't get the echo.
I'm hard of hearing, so
okay.
I didn't know that there was an echo.
Yeah, we can hear the computer in the background, and
oh.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite well. Good that you did. It could be disruptive for those who are listening.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
So you
were
welcome.
Going to make an observation.
Well, the first thing that I would like to comment on is the commandment to love your neighbor, Le'ahavta et l'recha. That also is the command from which Jesus got the concept of to love your enemy, because ra'ah can also be the word for one who is evil or one who is an enemy to truth. So he got the commandment to love your neighbor and to love your enemy from the same source, and that being Leviticus 19:18. And so I thought I might want to bring that out, because it is what considered by the rabbis and by the one I consider to be Jesus' own teacher, Hillel, as the very center of the entire Torah, that there are as many verses on one side of that verse as there are on the other side, from Genesis to Leviticus 19, and from Leviticus 19 to Deuteronomy at the end, which we're reading this week, in fact, on Simchat Torah, the end of the book of Deuteronomy, and beginning the Bible over again. So that was my comment on love. The Hebrew word love, ahava, actually means to take responsibility for, to incur upon oneself a sense of responsibility.
Wow, that's beautiful.
So it has nothing to do with eros, and there isn't a Hebrew concept of eros.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I wanted to mention that. And also, the word tame, unclean. In Hebrew, it actually refers not to uncleanliness as much as ritual impurity.
Mm-hmm.
It is badly translated as unclean in English.
Okay.
But it imposes in English a sense of dirty or filthy.
Right.
Whereas in Hebrew, it is a ritual thing rather than a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things cannot become unclean, like stone, utensils like cups that are cut out of soapstone cannot incur uncleanliness.
I'm curious, Rabbi, what are the kinds of things that you think, and I'm curious for Brian's thoughts on this too, where do you see us best interfacing? Like, for instance, with Judaism and Christianity, some people may have these kinds of misinterpretations, for instance, about uncleanness and various concepts. But when we look at some of the elevated concepts of both religions, where do you think we have the best chance for dialogue between the two faiths, and maybe even among all the Abrahamic faiths, including Islam?
Well, yeah. I wouldn't just limit it to Abrahamic faiths.
Okay.
Because according to my Brahmin neighbor, Brahmism is also an Abrahamic faith, as when Abraham sent his sons to the east, they became the Brahmists. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it's his tradition.
Huh.
I think it is, actually.
Pardon?
Well, I said I think that is true.
Yeah, it's. I looked it up in Genesis 25. I do know that Abraham sent his sons to the east, but I didn't know.
Right.
I don't know what happened to them.
Hmm.
So, in my opinion, there should be no limit to who we dialogue with, and especially on religion. I learned more about how to hear my own tradition sitting in a Navajo hogan, listening to the Navajo creation story as told by a professor of anthropology of the University of Southern Utah. And believe me, I think you can learn a great deal from people of other faiths about your own faith. I think we have to get past the need to proselytize and convert others to the way we see things.
Mm.
And rather seek to understand how they see things. You know,
right.
We all see truth as though through a diamond with many facets, each of us looking through our own facet and seeing it through our own eyes, the facet being the facet of our own upbringing, our own education, and our cultural values. So, and I think those are all valuable to how we see truth and should not be discounted in any way.
Right. Brian, I remember I remember in your NPR interview that you said, you know, you grew up with evangelizing essentially being equated with proselytizing, and that a good deal of your current thinking is really about having transcended that idea of proselytizing as being sort of a holdover of that us and them thinking. Do you want to expand on that?
Yes. Well, first, I think all of us want to say thanks to the rabbi for his beautiful comments. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So if you don't mind, I'll cut off the phone and listen to you again back on the computer.
Thank
Wonderful.
You, Rabbi.
Thank you so much for your contribution.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And again, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
But this distinction between proselytizing and evangelizing, I think, is a worthwhile one. The proselytizing spirit, I think, goes along with colonialism and a spirit of empire that says we are not safe as long as they are around. And so they need to be either eliminated or marginalized or banished or converted so they'll be just like us. And, so this inherent fear of the other as other it's based on this idea of safety through domination and the elimination of difference. I don't see what Jesus meant when he said to his disciples, go and preach the good news. He didn't say, go and convert everyone to our religion. He was saying, basically, I've given you a treasure. I've given you an example of a way to live. I've given you some teachings full of wisdom. I've given you so much to follow. And now I want you to go everywhere and make and share this with anyone who's willing and interested. But that doesn't require conversion. It just is an offer of a gift. Interestingly, the two groups that I think have helped me understand this more than anybody else are my Jewish friends and my Buddhist friends.
Wow.
And for that very reason. When I talk to my Jewish friends and they share with me, just as the rabbi just did, treasures from the Torah, treasures from the prophets, treasures from stories of great rabbis through history, and so on. Those are precious gifts that they give me and precious insights they give me. I gain so much from that. And they aren't saying, you can't have any more of these treasures unless you convert. You know, they're saying, I want to offer this to you. The same with my Buddhist friends. They tell me stories from the Buddha, or they tell me the meaning of a Sanskrit word that is very important to them. And those are gifts that I am so glad that they give. You know, they also don't ask me to say that I agree with it in every detail. They just offer it to me. And that's the spirit that I think we all can have, this sense that we've all been given gifts, that our gifts differ, and that we can offer those gifts to one another. And a little bit like the image Jesus gave of throwing out seeds, planting seeds, and wherever they find a place to grow, that's great.
Isn't that so beautiful? And, you know, having gone to the Parliament of the World's Religions the last four times, what I've noticed in talking to other religionists, especially religionists who are comfortable with their own beliefs, is they're very interested in what you think, and they're very interested in sharing at that level what you just described, Brian. They want to share. It's a gift, and they just want to share it with you. And you can take it graciously and lovingly or not, but at that level of sharing, when you're with interfaith people, they share lovingly and graciously, and you accept, and you share, and they accept. Oh, my, it is such a wonderful exchange. It's just valuable and priceless. So rich. Just hearing you talk about the things that they've given you makes me think back to conversations I've had that I'll treasure forever. Another caller. Can we take another caller?
Well, let's go ahead.
Okay.
Sure.
I think this is Pam. Pam, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, wonderful to have you on with us, Brian. I'm so thrilled. This is Pamela Chaddock, and I've been a big fan of yours for several years now, and I'm just getting more and more inspired all the time. One of the things I wanted to ask you that you had mentioned in your book that I've had this question for several years, and it's about the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And you mentioned that when you were a young child, maybe around 12 or so, you had brought the subject up to your mother, and she discounted that. You know, those terms, and you seemed a little confused by it, and I was really glad to see you write about that, because it seems to me that the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man is the most beautiful aspect of Jesus's gospel, that it really indicates the inclusiveness of his gospel, and that it, to me, it's the umbrella under which all the religions are united. It seems to be the term that really sort of holds the religion of Jesus, and is inclusive of all the different religions. And it's almost as if, like what Paula was just saying about the parliament, it's like they understand that. And yet, I wanted to find out from you why you thought Christianity is offended or distances itself from the idea of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Hello?
Brian? Oh, did we lose Brian?
Well, Brian, if you want to call back in.
Here, I think we have him. Brian, is that you?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't realize you dropped off. I'm sorry.
That's okay. The good news was I could hear everything there. And thanks so much for that question. Something happened in the Christian tradition in America over the last 120 years or so. We had a gradual rift between liberals and conservatives. And what tended to happen is that conservatives emphasized personal commitment, personal sin, and personal salvation. And liberals tended to emphasize social sin, social reconciliation, in my opinion, there's strength and value on both sides. But it's tragic when we each lose something when we start moving in opposition to the other. And in the early 20th century, there was a movement called the Social Gospel Movement, and they really wanted to emphasize this reality, exactly as you said, of the inclusiveness of Christ's gospel. Other people saw that as a watering down of their previous conviction. What I and many of my friends are really trying to do is help us realize that particular argument of the liberals and the conservatives has left us not only polarized but also paralyzed. And to move forward now, we have to try to put back some things that were divided and put it out with each other. But to me, one of the great ways of picturing this is to think about the Eucharist, which tells us that life is not a fight, life is not a war, but life is a feast, and that God has a place for us at the table. We're welcome to that table. And so when you think of life as a feast, you also think of the whole universe as a family, or a cosmic citizenship, if you will, and that there's a place for everybody, that everybody's welcome, everybody belongs. So that's why when I was a boy, I was surprised to learn that some Christians didn't like that idea, when I see it now as being, just as you said, central to the teaching of Jesus.
Thank you very much.
How did you come to these conclusions in your own life, Brian?
Well, one of the great gifts in my life was that I did become a pastor, which meant that a couple of times a week I would be preaching, using the Bible, or I would be leading a Bible study or some other kind of a class. And what this did over a long period of time is it forced me to actually read the whole Bible many, many times and engage with it deeply. And what I started to realize is that a lot of my theological training that claimed to take the Bible very seriously actually had a kind of a highly selective way of reading the Bible, and we only focused on certain themes. I grew up in this tradition that really emphasized personal sin and guilt and so on. But one of the verses that I memorized when I was a boy was from the from the Hebrew scriptures, the book of Isaiah, that says, though your sins are as scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they are as crimson, they will be as wool. So this picture that you're dark and blood-stained with sin, but you can be forgiven and made pure. And we love to quote that verse because for us, the big story was getting forgiven so that God would not condemn us. And then I remember when I was a preacher and I was reading through the book of Isaiah, and the verses before that verse and the verses after that verse specify the kinds of sins that Isaiah was concerned about. You don't care about the widows. You don't care about the orphans. You're just hypocrites who only argue about religious things, but you don't seek justice for the oppressed. And I thought to myself, I've been carefully trained to read that one verse and not read the verses before it or after it. And so when you try to get a more comprehensive and integrated and honest vision, that's what started making me have to give a lot of things a second thought.
Well, and it goes back to your, you mentioned a friend who became an atheist because he became disillusioned, and you can almost see how that happens then.
Yeah.
For certain. Shall we take another caller? Okay. Caller, you're with us on Blog Talk, and Brian McLaren.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, this is me.
Yeah, it is you.
I don't know if you remember me. My name's David.
Hi, David, from Dallas.
Yeah. I feel like I've come home.
Oh, you
I want to thank you folks for being there. Just want to shortly review what happened this week. As a result of, we were talking last week about religion and how the effects that has. So this week I re-upped my covenant with my thought adjuster and have got the communication flowing again. And he unlocked a key for me for something I've been seeking for all of my life. And this is going to tie into a question for Brian. I'm an engineer by profession, so first 40 years was spent in studying physical power. In 1984, I stepped into the spirit world, which was totally brand new, so I immersed myself in that. And now what we're doing is joining the two. So what interested me was the transmutation of spiritual power into physical power. And, the physicists have been looking into this. The energy that just kind of exists out there, and they're trying to invent machines to do it. And the key is God has already done it, and it's us. But it involves our making a connection with our thought adjuster by mediation of the mind, which he explained to me is like you do a mind meld. If you do a mind meld with your thought adjuster, that bridges the gap, and so he can let the power flow. And I've experienced that. I just didn't understand it. And so what I'm looking at is when I immerse myself in the Bible, it's kind of an operations manual, like you get a TV, mm-hmm. and you get the operations manual. And he's held off my getting into the Urantia book because it's a service manual. It gives the circuit diagrams and the nuts and bolts so we can really understand what's happening. So now for Brian, in the words of a talk show host here in Dallas, I love you, man. I think we'll be working together. I'll definitely buy your book. I want to relate an experience. I was working with a church, and we were bringing a lady out of Satanism. Now, that's about the biggest ism you can get, I think, as far as a differentiation. But the key was she was trying to come out of it and was seeking the truth, and we were ministering to her. That's kind of like in the physical. I enjoy arguing with an engineer because we're both seeking truth, and we can have very heated discussions. But when once the realization is there of what the truth is, the one goes, oh, yeah, I understand, you know, and we're friends all the way through it. Anyway, we had been working with this lady. We were in a service one time, and you know, when the Spirit was beginning to flow, and the Lord had me go lie prostrate on the edge of the building. And I felt myself sobbing, you know, little heaves of sobbing. I looked up and saw her about 50 feet away, and she was doing the same thing. Then I pointed to her and began to speak in tongues, and people observed a fire coming from my mouth going straight into her. Now, what I thought this probably was, or it was revealed to me, is that my spirit of God, that thought adjuster, that spark, connected with hers, and as long as we were both seeking the truth, he could, through me, impart what he had to do right then, which would be the ministry to break through all that garbage, all that spiritual garbage that had been piled on her. And I think this is the essence of what we're trying to talk about, is all the religious stuff doesn't make any difference as long as we're after the essence of this truth and the relationship. Now just take your comment.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Well, Brian, what do you think? I should clarify for our listeners that thought adjuster is another term for the God within. He's talking about the powerful connection that one has with God within them. Brian, are you there still?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, a couple of thoughts. First, I was intrigued. Was it David? I forgot his name.
Yeah, David. Yes. David in Dallas, yes.
One of the things David said that I just caught my attention at the very beginning is he talked about the relationship between physical energy, the kind an engineer would study, and spiritual energy. And it just brought to mind something I think of whenever I'm in an airplane. obviously, you're experiencing an awful lot of engineering when you're in an airplane. Then you're experiencing the realities of all kinds of physical energy. But what makes me get in a plane to come home after I travel somewhere? Well, it's love for my wife. It's love for my family. So in an interesting way, the spiritual energy of love is what motivates me to engage with all of this physical energy. And in a sense, I think of this, I don't think of it every time, but often when I have a meal and I say grace before the meal, I thank God for the gift of food and for the connection I have to farmers and harvesters and so on as I eat. I'm asking for that physical energy that came from the sun and was converted into plants and animals and now is nourishing me. I want that physical energy to be used for good purposes, love and justice and service and so on. At any rate, I just think his comment brings to mind how these things are really related, that all of this physical energy can be used for purposes of love and justice and harmony and peace. I also just kind of seized on the word that David used, that term religious garbage. And the truth is that an awful lot of us do, we end up with a lot of wounds from religious communities. Mm. And so much of the healing that has to be done in the world is healing from the unintended consequences, negative consequences of a lot of our religious systems. In the book, when I talk about this pursuit of strong and benevolent Christian identity, one of the things I do is I talk about four challenges we have to come over. First, we have to overcome. First is the historical challenge. We have to come to terms with the historical roots of some of our religious hostility. Second is the doctrinal challenge. Third is the liturgical. And fourth is the missional. But that doctrinal challenge is the one that also came to mind when David was speaking. My friend Diana Butler-Bass reminded me not long ago that doctrine, to a lot of people, just means a lot of this religious garbage. It means ideas and opinions and statements that are used to exclude and insult and oppress and so on. But she points out that the root of that word doctrine is the word doctor, and that the original word in the Old French, I believe it was, came from the idea that spiritual teachings are healing teachings. They're teachings that doctor the soul. They're truths, they're wisdom that are like doctors for the soul. And so this, to me, is our great opportunity to try to distinguish between teachings that wound people, that cripple people, that are piled on people, and teachings that actually are healing and liberating for people.
Well, and when
great
you...
Great distinction.
Yes, a wonderful distinction. And to me, often as a minister, I look out at the world and I see it already burdened with so many things like shame, blame, guilt, doubt, fear, despair. And, you know, I think of the words of Jesus saying, you know, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. And I've pondered, what will the truth make me free of? And my conclusion is it will make me free of shame, blame, guilt, doubt, fear, and despair. And so that's a way to know the truth when you hear it. And I think if Jesus were here, he'd be more about taking some of those burdens from us. I know he would. He wouldn't heap any more of them on us. He knows that we already have too much. He would take them from us. And he would lift us up. He would lighten us up by taking the fear and the shame and the blame and the doubt. And that's what he did. You know, he was truly the greatest doctor of all, the greatest physician of all, to heal the brokenhearted, to bind up the brokenhearted, as he said, and to liberate the spiritual captives. So I love that, Brian. And even just the study of words and language, not just history, but it's so important to understand what it is we're actually saying to each other.
Yes. Yes. You know, this brings to mind one of the real challenges in all interfaith work, and that is to figure out what to do when we come up against honest difference. There's a Christian theologian out at Claremont Seminary in California named John Cobb. And John, I think, makes a very interesting proposal. He speaks of he uses a big word for it, the incommensurability of religions. Now, what he means by that is that in some cases, our different religious traditions are not proposing two kinds of apples or five kinds of apples. They're actually talking about apples and oranges. And just to give two clarifying examples, we've all heard the old story about the blind man and the elephant. You know, that they go out and one says, oh, this thing is like a rope because he can only access it through touch. He can't see it. And another person feels the side of the elephant and says, oh, it's like a wall. And another person feels the leg. Oh, it's like a tree. And of course, and there's a lot of truth in that story. We can all be perceiving different parts of the truth. But then someone might come along and say, yeah, but what would happen if several blind men walked out and one grabbed a hold of a giraffe and one grabbed a hold of an elephant and one grabbed a hold of a lion's tail? You know, at that point, there's incommensurability. They're not talking about different parts of one reality. They're talking about some different realities altogether. And I think it can help us in interfaith dialogue to give permission to our different religions to be talking about different animals, to be talking about different things. I don't mean different gods as if there are many gods, but one, you could say, for example, that Buddhism isn't framed around the existence of God. In many ways, I mean, it's terrible to ever try to summarize any religion in a sentence or two, but one of the great interests of Buddhism is suffering and what relieves suffering. And that pursuit, Buddhists can pursue that question without having much to say about God or heaven or hell and so on. Meanwhile, Islam is interested in a different set of questions and Judaism in a slightly different set. And one of the great pursuits of my life is asking what really should be the pursuit of the Christian faith. Largely, in a lot of our Christian history, especially Western Christian history, the pursuit of the Christian faith was about what happens after we die. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened to me as I was a pastor really engaging week after week with the Bible and especially with the teachings of Jesus is that I came to realize that, at worst a misunderstanding and at best a partial understanding. Because I look, for example, at the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Then it doesn't say, may we go to your kingdom when we die where your will is done. It's not about evacuation. It's about transformation. It's may your kingdom come, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So I came to realize that my obsession with what happens after death sometimes is just not the obsession of Jesus. Jesus focuses what's happening in this world and how can what happens in this world be more what God dreams to happen.
More heavenly here.
Yes, exactly. So at any rate, I think this can maybe help us sometimes when we think about differences in religions. They're not saying different things about the same thing sometimes. They're actually talking about different things entirely. And so we don't have to get into an argument. We can just realize there are many different things to talk about.
Absolutely. And we can add understanding to all of them just by first having the dialogue and first the conversation. And there's a great question on the board, and our friend Jim has been trying to ask you this question for a while. So he says, I believe people are saved not by objective truth, but by Jesus. Their faith isn't in their knowledge, but in God. So he asks, is God not absolute objective truth?
Well, those are really loaded words. The word absolute and the word objective and the word truth, we really could talk about the history of those words and where they come from. But if we want to all say, if we believe in a God who's a creator, one way to say it is, if we were to subtract the entire universe, everything that's been created, then whatever pre-exists that's what we're talking about when we talk about God. And if we want to say that's the absolute truth and that's the objective truth at that point, certainly we could say that. But I'm also interested in his use of the word saved, because for a lot of people, especially people who grew up in my background, we define that word saved based on a set of assumptions that I actually don't think fit very much what we find in the Bible. So for a lot of us, saved means go to heaven when we die as opposed to going to hell. For some people, they might be a little more sophisticated, and they would say saved means saved from the consequences of something called the fall and something called original sin, terms that don't actually appear in the Bible that really develop later in Christian history. I notice when I go back and read the Bible that first real meaning of the word saved comes up in the story of the Hebrew children being liberated from slavery in Egypt. When they were calling out for salvation, they weren't calling out to die and go to heaven. They were calling out to be set free from having to make bricks for Pharaoh. So the original meaning of salvation is liberation, liberation very specifically from slavery and oppression and dehumanization and so on. That word saved and salvation then begins to take on a broader meaning, to be saved from any trouble, to be saved from any kind of oppression, not just physical slavery. And I think it's helpful to keep that in mind when we read the Bible. We can import later theological definitions, but I think it's much fairer to go and try to say, what did this word mean to the people who were originally speaking it? What was the context and backstory to them? And when we do that, I think we get a much richer understanding of the word saved, although it's very disturbing to many Christians to have to go through that thought process.
Hmm.
How do you help people? I mean, to me, this is like right at the heart of what kind of holds Christianity back from being that beautiful and strong and benevolent faith that it can be, is this idea that, you know, that some aren't saved and that some are going to hell. You know, hell is such a powerful, amazing consequence for being human and confused, you know.
Yes.
And it just always astonishes me that anybody would think that a loving God would resort to something like that.
Well, in fact, Brian, didn't you have a wonderful dialogue with your daughter Jess about just that very subject?
Yes, that's a fictional dialogue, but it reflects a lot of conversations I had with my own children.
Okay.
I wrote a whole book on this subject. It was called The Last Word and the Word After That. So if people are interested, they might find that book helpful. This really is a key question. And to me, even deeper than the question of heaven and hell, then, is what picture of God that gives us. You know, do we really perceive of God as a God who can't be happy unless people who've done wrong are being punished in some horrible way? Some people say, yes, that's the way God is, and that's in some ways what I was taught. But I just can't square that with everything else that I know about God, and I can't square that with the experience of grace that I've received, and I really can't square it with the example of Jesus. And again, here's where, you know, my life got complicated when I really started paying attention to what was actually in the biblical text and allowed that to critique some of what I've been taught. Just as a quick example, I think I was in my 40s. I'd been reading the Bible for decades by this time before I realized that the word hell never occurs in the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, if you have an old King James Bible, you might see it, because it mistranslates the Hebrew word Sheol with this later word hell. But Sheol, the Hebrew word, simply means place of the dead. So it's where everybody goes. And so then that got my curiosity up. What was the history of the idea of hell and the word hell? And that's what I tried to write about in this book, The Last Word and the Word After That.
Wonderful.
Well, let's take maybe we can take a couple more callers. We don't have much time left, Brian, and I'm just so disappointed because we could probably stay on with you all day, but I know you are a busy man. And so let's try to get a couple more callers in if we can. Caller, you're with us on The Cosmic Citizen with Brian McLaren.
Hello?
Hello? Hi.
Hello?
Hello, you're with us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wanted to just call in here. You kind of got beyond my thoughts when I first called. You're talking about enslavement that we find lots of times in the people through their religions. And you mentioned, you know, like Christ got us free. And he says the truth will learn us, will make us free. And one of the things that lots of times like Paul wrote, I think it's in Galatians, where he said that, what is it that has re-enslaved you now that you had found the freedom of the Christ? And now you're re-enslaved again. And we find, I feel, many times, as people starting to, they get the freedom of sonship and salvation and everything through the teachings, and then they turn around, and then they lose that by being, like you mentioned, I think it was worthiness, or lack of worthiness. And so then they get stuck into a quest of approval.
Mm-hmm.
And like a child, though, a child in a relationship with their parents know who they are, and they know that that state is undeniable, you could say.
Uh-huh.
And we find, like in society, there's a segment of people that don't have heart disease and cancer worldwide. You'll find them in any nation. And it really validates this aspect of enslaving and being free, and whether or not we live our life for self-approval of other people's values are being honest with ourselves. And that segment of society is the mentally retarded. They don't, as a class, have cancer or heart disease because they're always in the moment. They're in that euphoric joy of presence. And,
caller, could we get Brian's response to your thoughts?
Sure. Well, thanks for you bringing up a couple things there again that I think are very interesting. But that passage from Galatians that you referred to of being free and then subjecting ourselves to new kinds of enslavement, I think we all have experienced that. We find out that we can get the slavery, we can get out of slavery easier than we can get the slavery out of us sometimes.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
And I think you're exactly right. Our great struggle is to accept our acceptance. Our great struggle is to realize, as you said, that this is not about worthiness. This is not about earning anything. This is not about achievement. And I think this is one of the powerful images, powerful meanings that comes with this image of God as Father that was so important to Jesus. You know, today when people hear that term, they think of patriarchy and so on. But I think in Jesus' day, when he is talking about this, he's trying to say, listen, you can know who you are. You are a child in God's family, and you are beloved simply because you exist. Your being loved is not doesn't say anything about how lovable you are. It says everything about how loving God is. And so you are loved when you're lovable and when you're not. My wife and I have two grandchildren, and it's so much fun watching our children now be parents. And I was talking with my daughter the other day. Her daughter was sick and was throwing up, and, you know, it was just really hard. And my daughter said to me, wow, I think of how many times you went through this with me, and I don't even remember it. And thankfully, I don't either remember it all. But you know, at that moment, you know, when your child is sick, it's not a happy, fun time. But it doesn't change the fact that you love your child at all. And I think that helps us imagine something about the love of God and helps us to get free and stay free. So I really appreciate you bringing that perpetual problem up. And this, again, is one of the ways that religion sometimes harms us, because it, by telling us all the good things that we can and should and might be doing, sometimes we accept those as burdens and that we're not fulfilling, and we have to go back and remember that this is a grace-based universe. It's not an earning-based universe.
That's kind of a big concept for us to get to from the sort of small flat world view that, you know, we had even 500 to 1,000 years ago, let alone 2,000 to 4,000 to 6,000 years back, you know?
Yes.
When you think about what we're learning about where we live, where, you know, where we are in relationship to the universe, our concepts of God have had to really expand.
Yes.
Let's try to get in another. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Kristen.
Well, I think we're down to the last 5 minutes. I would say
yeah.
that we're at risk if we take another caller now.
Okay. Well, my apologies to you callers. But maybe
I would like
to
let Brian sort of wrap things up, and then I'd like to just really briefly mention a little bit about our guest for next week. So what
yes,
do you think of all of the things that you've spoken about today, or maybe you haven't mentioned yet, is one of the most important aspects of this benevolent strength and tolerance that you'd like to share with the audience from your book?
Yes. Maybe I could just tell a quick story. I was just doing some reading earlier this morning about a time in European history when Christians were treating Jewish people terribly. And in fact, not only that, but Protestant Christians were treating Catholics terribly, and Catholics were treating Protestants terribly. And one group that everybody treated terribly were the Quakers. And I'm not exactly sure why everybody hated them so much, but at that time they did. And I was reading a statement written by the mayor of Amsterdam. What he wanted to say was, we want our city to be a place where Catholics and Protestants and Jews and even Quakers are welcome and accepted. And here he said, because we know them all to be children of Adam. And what struck me about that statement is he was taking the biblical story of creation and using that story to legitimize our obligation to see everybody as a relative, to see that we're all related. And so here's our great opportunity. We have a lot of people who use religion as an excuse for violence and hatred and fear and prejudice. But our great opportunity is to go back into our text, and for us as Christians this means going back into the Bible and finding the very reasons for us to love one another and work together and move toward one another. And I think that's one of the really important ways that all of us can let our light shine and make a difference in a time when there's an awful lot of darkness out there.
Yeah, don't get overwhelmed by it. Just let it shine.
And I think if we really do believe his word, if we really do believe sort of the promise of Jesus, is that the world is going to work out okay in the end. It is all
yes.
going to be okay.
Yes.
And we're really not in charge of the whole, you know, of fixing everything.
That's a good reminder.
And you really have a refreshing new twist to the gospel to focus on the love of Jesus as a reason to move out of the olden exclusivist attitude into the new inclusive attitude. That even those that aren't self-identifying as Christians may in fact be saved, even as Christians are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jesus would save us all and have us all be saved, you know?
Yeah.
Because we are all precious in his eyes. And Brian, you know, from my heart, thank you so much for your work, for your tireless effort for humanity. And to gently remind Christians of who Jesus is and that we can be like him. He holds the bar really high, but I think that we can strive to be more like him. And certainly that's what the world needs most. So
thank you so much.
For
being with us for 2 whole hours in your busy schedule. You have no idea how much it means to us all.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's been really enjoyable. Appreciated the calls and all of your comments, and thanks so much for your interest.
And
thank
Lala,
you
very
I love
much.
Coming at you from our board too.
Yeah.
You. Yeah.
Very well, generous and just refreshing dialogue. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so
and
much.
And keep on writing these wonderful books. We're so happy that you're so prolific.
Yeah.
And we hope you'll join us again when your next one comes out.
Okay.
And to our listeners, go to www.brianmclaren.net to get information on Brian and all of his books.
And just a heads up, for next week we're going to have Phyllis Tickle with us. She's also a theologian and author. And join us at the same time, same station, here on Blog Talk Radio, Cosmic Citizen, at noon Eastern Time till 2 p.m. It's a two-hour show each week. We hope you'll join us and share our show with your friends.
Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you, friends. Until next time, this is a Cosmic Citizen.
Bye for
Have
now.
Have a good week, everyone. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Aramshavuk and its teachings. The Aramshavuk is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Aramshavuk reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Aramsha organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Aramshavuk. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the host, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.